The digital tide is high and rising at leading publishing education programs. A survey of programs finds more courses than ever on metadata and SEO, with the number of graduates finding digital-driven jobs growing too. In children's fiction, a boxed review from Maggot Moon by Sally Gardner and illustrated by Julian Crouch, set in a fictional motherland in the middle of the space race and starring a dyslexic 15-year-old. The flipbook-style illustrations teem with flies, rats, and maggots. Oh, my. Welcome, everyone, to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. My name is Christopher Keneally, host of Beyond the Book, and every week on Friday, we turn to the writers and editors of Publishers Weekly for a look at the week ahead, a preview of news that everyone in publishing will be talking about. Joining me from PW's New York office, as always, is Andrew Albanese, magazine's senior writer. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Andrew.
Greetings, Chris.
Well, you know, we do follow the pace of digital sales here and Beyond the Book as closely as we can, and it gives us an idea of how quickly the business is changing. But in Monday's issue, PW has a look at how digital is changing the book business in a way we haven't seen before.
Absolutely. And you know me, Chris, I have two little ones, so I very much believe that the children are the future. And in Monday's issue, our Gabe Habash surveyed eight leading publishing education programs from around the country and reports that the digital surge is even sharper than the surge we're seeing in things like digital revenues and ebook sales. We're talking about students and publishing programs like NYU's and Pace and Yale, to name a few. And let me just throw some numbers out there for you. In 2007, noted Andrea Chambers, who's the director of NYU's program, just 6% of grads landed jobs in digital. That number, as of last year, is over 30%. 5 years ago, NYU offered just 3 digital courses. They now offer 17. Now, some skills, of course, when it comes to publishing are timeless. New hires still need to have good reading and writing skills, of course. But publishers are very much now expecting their candidates to be familiar with the world of apps, code, and mobile. And the industry vocabulary, as you noted, is now dominated by things like EPUB and DRM and SEO and metadata. So sure, you can still look at how the sales of ebooks are measuring up and what that portends for the digital shift and what that all means for the industry. But Gabe's article, which takes a look at how we're educating and training our future publishing employees and also looks at who's getting hired and how and where, is a real eye-opener. Certainly, it's a long way from where I began back in 1989 when the only barrier to me to getting a job was passing a typing test.
Typing tests, I remember those too. Well, you know, the effect of digital and publishing is pervasive and nowhere more so than in libraries. And PW has a look in the next issue from a global perspective about this topic. And Peter Bradley tells us that the picture is a rather disturbing one.
Yeah, it's definitely a little unsettling. The word I would really use is urgent. In Monday's issue, as you know, Peter reports from an advisory meeting for IFLA, which is the International Federation of Library Associations, that was assembled at IFLA's headquarters at The Hague in the Netherlands. It brought together 25 key thinkers for a 3-day discussion about the library ebook situation. The takeaway, Peter reports, is that advisors told IFLA that they really have 2 or 3 years to punch through the current impasse over library ebook lending, or libraries risk losing their central place in the world's literary culture. One of the things that really impressed me about this report is that it offered a really good look at this as a global issue. It's not just about how talks have broken down between publishers and libraries in the U.S. It's going on all over the world. So we're going to look forward to see what IFLA does with this meeting and what recommendations it's eventually going to make to its board. But more importantly, we're going to look forward to how many of these recommendations are going to be truly actionable. Because let's face it, as you know, tablets and smartphones and e-readers continue to proliferate, libraries need to be in that space or they're going to be left behind.
Well, indeed. And, you know, the story of 2012 has been a story of digital. And I suppose as the year draws to a close, we should remind people this will be our last podcast of the year. The week ahead will return on January 11th, and we'll be in 2013 by that point. So last words, Andrew, for you on 2012 from the publishing perspective.
Well, it was a pretty slow year. There's really nothing much to talk about, is there?
No, I don't even know why we bother.
Ha ha ha. Okay, I guess there's a few things worth mentioning. You know, first, and this may seem odd that I would raise this first, but I'm very interested in the rise of self-publishing, and it's something that I plan to devote a lot more attention to in the next year. And in our last issue of the year, December 24th issue of PW, I have a recap of a session that you hosted in Miami at the Miami Book Fair, featuring Mark Coker of Smashwords, author MJ Rose, writers Jenny Pedroza from the Writers Coffee House, who pretty much discovered and published 50 Shades of Grey, Neil James, and Vux Mackavnar. Now, not to flatter the host of our show here, but Chris, I have to tell you, that was the best panel on self-publishing that I've been to. And believe me, I've been to many over the last year or two. And largely because I found that the audience that came was really engaged. And it was a pretty big audience. It was a very big audience. It was a full room. And I just found that they clearly, this audience had accepted self-publishing as a very viable option. You know, they did not come to that panel to hear about whether or not they should self-publish, but rather how to do it and how to do it well. So I really got a sense that we've moved on from the questions of veracity that dogged the Vanity Press era, and that we're on the cusp of something profoundly, you know, owing mostly to the ebook and technology, that I think is going to really profoundly reshape the book business in a lot of ways. And for a few reasons, you know, first, every week we read about a big publisher picking up a self-published author. And I think that's, you know, as MJ Rose said on the panel, the slush pile, self-publishing is the new slush pile. I think author or publishers are going to find a lot of authors in the self-publishing space, yes. You know, where this was once like a dream scenario that you would self-publish a book and a publisher would pick it up, self-publishing almost now seems like a development stage where writers can demonstrate their talent and their drive and their savvy. But I also think that self-publishing is really going to influence the market as more credible self-published books begin to sell. It's going to affect everything from the prices of ebooks to the royalty rates that publishers are going to end up paying, among other things. So one of the key things I'm going to look forward to in 2013 is following the rise and continued acceptance of self-publishing. And you'll want to check out my article in the December 24th issue of PW Select.
Right. Well, you know, Andrew, I happen to agree 100% with what you're saying about self-publishing. And in my view, self-publishing is no longer really the right way to call what's happening out there, because this is publishing by a new form, but it's not self-publishing only. It's publishing for individuals, for organizations, for associations, museums, and the self-publishing name just does still ring from the Vanity Press era, and I think we need to find a new way to call it what it is. It's going to change the business more than I think Amazon did, more than the ebook readers have, and it's a story I know you'll be following. We'll be following at Copyright Clearance Center, and I think I enjoy the Miami Book Fair particularly because, unlike all the other conferences you and I attend, this is a public book fair. So you've got an audience of the readers out there, rather than just professionals and colleagues who kind of talk to themselves, if you will. Here we really have to talk to an audience that matters. It's those readers, after all, that the authors and publishers are chasing after.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more with what you're saying about the moniker of self-publishing, because you still do see, when you mention the word self-publishing, a lot of people sort of roll their eyes. That really, I think, is something that we're going to see begin to change in 2013. And I would be open to coming up with another name for it. So if you have any ideas, let's throw a few out.
You'll hear them. You'll hear them first, and so will everybody else listening to our program. What else on the year that was the January 7th issue coming out? I believe there's a feature on the major stories of 2012.
You know, it's one of the things we love to do in January, but we'll take a deeper look back at 2012 in our January 7th issue, which is the first issue of 2013. And I am going to have a feature in there that's looking back on a lot of the major stories. And there were many, of course. You know, we have the Department of Justice price fixing scandal and the settlement and what that's all going to mean in 2013. You know, there were a slew of lawsuits, including the Google stuff, winding its way to resolution. So we'll look at what's going on there and whether or not any of those issues wind up in legislatures in the coming year. And of course, we have a big merger between Penguin and Random House that we're going to try to sort out as well. So we'll be taking a few weeks off from the podcast here, but the world is going to keep spinning. And when we next get together to chat, I imagine we're going to have a lot to talk about. But let me be the first to say, happy holidays to everyone. And thank you all for your support. And I look forward to a great 2013. And if I don't speak to you by some strange twist, Chris, before the end of the year, happy holidays and happy new year to you as well.
Well, likewise, Andrew, and everyone there at Publishers Weekly. We've been chatting with Andrew Albanese, senior writer for Publishers Weekly, and he joins us every week for the week ahead. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
Now I want to turn to Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs at Genreville. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Rose.
Thank you, Chris. I can't believe it's our last show of the year.
It's amazing. We have gone through 2012, burned our way through 2012. And speaking,
We really have.
It seems like it's gone by in a shot. But speaking of burning, you're going to start out with fiction reviews and a book by Stephen Dobbins called The Burned Palace.
That's right. This is his follow-up to Eating Naked, and PW's review says The Burned Palace is, by turns, an affectionate portrait of small-town life, a terrifying supernatural thriller, and a sly horror comedy. Something is very wrong with the sleepy town of Brewster, Rhode Island, where a baby goes missing from its crib, a huge striped snake is put in its place, and a body is found scalped in the woods. In addition, murderous coyotes are making increasingly daring attacks on townspeople. And as the authorities descend from multiple jurisdictions, creating chaos, it takes the help of a young 10-year-old who may possess the town's only benign magical powers to give the people of Brewster a chance to defend themselves against something far darker than anyone imagined. And despite the novel's complexity, Dobbins gives his many characters space to come alive and allows each of the spooky subplots time to build maximum suspense. Also in fiction, Ways of Going Home is a wonderful novel within a novel by Chilean author Alejandro Zambra about the delayed unease of growing up during Augusto Pinochet's dictatorship. In the first section of the book, a 9-year-old boy meets a girl the night of a damaging earthquake. In the second, an author struggles to write a novel that will help him reconcile with his family's sympathy toward the Pinochet regime. And the first section, it turns out, is the novel, and the 9-year-old boy is conceivably a variation of the writer's younger self. And this two-way mirror effect allows the reader to contemplate the bewilderment of coming of age in a terrifying time, as well as the guilt, confusion, and attempt to make sense out of impossible choices that may well continue for a lifetime. We have a fiction Q&A with documentarian Margaret Wrinkle about her debut novel, Wash, which is a fictional take on the 19th century practice of slave breeding. What led Wrinkle to this story was, in part, she says, a desire to weave together the Western way of doing things, which is written law and historical proof, with the West African oral tradition. And these two paradigms coming together is part of the reason the South is not like any other part of the United States.
In mystery, you'll start out with a description of something involving an aristocratic sleuth in Regency, London.
That's right. This is C.S. Harris's What Darkness Brings. It's her 8th Regency era mystery featuring Sebastian St. Cyr, who is the aristocratic sleuth. He looks into the fatal shooting of a wealthy London merchant who tried to sell one of the French crown jewels that went missing in 1792. And the combination of complex backstory, intricate plotting, surprising developments, and poignant evocations of the lives of the underprivileged make this one of the best entries in this superior historical mystery series. Also, a surprising plot and deceptively simple prose distinguish Chris Morgan Jones's The Jackal's Smile, in which British investigator Ben Webster, who works for a boutique London firm that specializes in corporate work, has doubts about helping a wealthy Iranian expatriate sell the family business. The novel's power derives mainly from its nuanced look at Webster's struggle to balance his principles and his responsibilities to his family. And the Q&A in the mystery thriller section is with Australian author Carrie Greenwood, who launches a new series set in ancient Egypt with Out of the Black Land.
In science fiction, you'll start off with a title from Caitlin Kiernan.
Well, Caitlin Kiernan's name is on the cover, but it's writing as. The book is called Blood Oranges, and it's by Caitlin Kiernan writing as Kathleen Tierney. It's her first urban fantasy novel, the start of a series. A gory whirl through numerous graveyards in the seamier parts of contemporary Providence, Rhode Island, introduces readers to narrator Siobhan Quinn, who hunts supernatural creatures. Then a werewolf and a vampire both bite her in the same night, and she becomes a monster herself, forcing her to adapt, improvise, and reconsider her allies as she searches for answers and vengeance. Quinn is queer, foul-mouthed, formerly homeless, ex-junkie, and a well-read high school dropout, and her idiosyncratic and thoroughly compelling voice will hook urban fantasy readers right away. Also in the science fiction, fantasy, and horror section, Marie Brennan's A Natural History of Dragons creates a country that more or less resembles 19th century England, except that fantastical creatures are wandering around, Judaism appears to be the dominant religion, and Europe once had a civilization that was sort of like ancient Egypt. Now, formal scientific career is still off limits to ladies in this version of the era and the place. So Isabella, Lady Trent, marries a man who shares her passion for natural history and then convinces him to let her join his expedition to see the wild dragons of Vistrana. And along the way, Isabella solves a mystery and proves her worth as a naturalist. Brennan's standalone novel, written and beautifully illustrated as a memoir of Isabella's youthful adventures, is saturated with the joy and urgency of discovery and scientific curiosity. I know a lot of people have been waiting a long time for this book, and it really sounds like it's living up to the hype. In romance, Jane Ashford delights with Once Again a Bride, a smoothly told historical double romance in which gentry and faithful servants alike find family, love, and belonging. Charlotte Wilde, abused and neglected by her husband, Henry, and when he's murdered by footpads, Charlotte is surprised to be taken in as family by the busy household of Henry's kind nephew, Sir Alexander Wilde. Alex slowly realizes what a gem Charlotte is as she discovers what it's like to have freedom. And meanwhile, Charlotte's maid, Lucy, catches the attention of sweet, sassy footman Ethan. And PW's reviewer says the simple novel offers a near-perfect example of everything that makes the romance genre an escapist joy to read. Unsought love triumphs despite difficult circumstances, unpleasantness is resolved, mysteries are cleared, and good people get the happy lives they deserve. And I have to say, I have a particular personal connection to this. The heroines' names are Charlotte and Lucy, which happen to be the names of my cousins, both of whom got married in the last couple of years. So as soon as this comes out, I know where I'm sending a couple of copies.
That sounds lovely. Well, in nonfiction, we'll start out with a book that describes an interesting time in Montana's Glacier National Park, a job that is one of the most underappreciated, I would think, in any kind of national park.
Undoubtedly so. This is Dirt Work, An Education in the Woods by Christine Bile, and it offers a chronicle of her years spent as a trail dog. She's a seasonal worker doing the backbreaking work of maintaining the wilderness trails. First, she was in Montana's Glacier National Park, as she said, and then later in Alaska in the Denali National Park. And her book offers a blend of beauty and crudeness and both grit and grace. Her most obvious love is for the people who work the trails with her, whose taciturn behavior, practical jokes, and machismo she must navigate, whose internal culture she learns as she becomes a part of the team, and whose mentorship is invaluable. We call it a beautiful memoir of muscle and metal. Also in nonfiction is Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela. This is an incisive portrait of a histrionic ruler who brooks little criticism. It's by Rory Carroll, who's the Latin American bureau chief for The Guardian, and it captures the tragic absurdity of life in a country flush with petrodollars, where many still go without adequate health care, and where out-of-order signs are switched out for ones promising socialist modernization, but the elevators are still broken down no matter what sign's on them. Readers who know Hugo Chavez mainly for his anti-U.S. bluster will find some surprises in the true-life black comedy surrounding this mercurial leader. The fraught politics of collaboration and guilt are dissected in Agata Tuschinska's darkly absorbing biography of Vera Gran, a Polish-Jewish torch singer who starred at the Warsaw Ghetto's Café Stuka and was dogged by post-war allegations that she collaborated with the Gestapo. Tuschinska's shrewd examination of this evidence largely absolves Gran, but her account is really a probing atmospheric study of the ghetto's moral ambiguities. This is a skillful translation by Charles Ruess that really brings clear Tuschinska's prose as it conveys Gran's story in brisk, evocative montage, while appropriately leaving open some enigmatic gaps. She finds no bright line of truth, just some subtle shades of gray that are even more revealing of a really nightmarish time and place. and the filthy, haphazardly arrayed Paris immortalized in Victor Hugo's Les Misérables gives way to the idealized tree-lined boulevards and planned building projects of the opulent Second French Empire in urban architecture blogger Stéphane Kirkland's debut, Paris Reborn. Long before Robert Moses set about sculpting New York City, Baron Haussmann, with the blessings of Napoleon III, the Napoleon's nephew, transformed Paris from a medieval maze into a modern metropolis, though, of course, the metamorphosis was not without its attendant obstacles. Kirkland is an able navigator of architectural history, so there are plenty of vivid descriptions, and the evolution of the city's infrastructure, public spaces, and other amenities is really a testament to the often overlooked reign of Napoleon III.
Well, that sounds fascinating, actually. It's funny how we think of Paris in the way that we know it today and neglect to imagine as it was in those past times. Thank you for that. And in children's, finally, we've got this book, Maggot Moon, that really sounds terrifying but appealing as well.
Yeah, we've got some really great fiction in the children's section in this issue. Maggot Moon is by Sally Gardner and illustrated by Julian Crouch. And we've seen a lot of dystopia in the YA world in the past few years, but this one really is pretty special. It's set in a fictional motherland in the middle of the space race and stars a dyslexic 15-year-old named Standish. Gardner, the author, is also dyslexic. So writing from experience. Living in the motherland's derelict Zone 7, Standish unwittingly discovers one of his nation's biggest secrets and sets out to expose it. Gardner really nails Standish's narrative voice and Crouch's flipbook-style illustrations, which teem with flies, rats, and maggots, both underscore the ruined setting and actually create a sense of hope by the end of the book, which is what readers will take away. We also review a new Amelia Bedelia book on the occasion of her 50th anniversary, hard to believe that, as well as a lovely picture book take on an African folktale called The Busy, Busy Little Chick, in which a small chick helps to pick up the slack when his mother drops the ball. And it's a story with echoes of Aesop's Ant and the Grasshopper, as well as The Little Red Hen. And finally, our pick of the week this week is Rage Against the Dying by Becky Masterman. If you pick this one up, resist the temptation to bail after the creepy prologue, which sexual predator's eye view of the woman he's about to attack. Because if you give up, you'll miss one of the most memorable FBI agents since Clarice Starling in this impressive debut thriller. At 59, Bridget Quinn has officially closed the book on a legendary and controversial bureau career, including years undercover. Then the authorities arrest trucker Floyd Lynch, who claims to be the Route 66 killer. Now, that's the one notorious homicide case that Quinn couldn't close, and which 7 years earlier claimed the life of her protege. But some things just don't add up, and the steely veteran finds herself thrust back into a nightmare that threatens to shatter her new life of domestic bliss if it doesn't get her killed. First-time novelist Masterman, who's the acquisitions editor for a press specializing in forensic medical textbooks, really ratchets up the suspense with a secondary plot that it would be criminal to reveal. So my lips are sealed. And that's the reviews this week.
Right. And with that, we will thank you for the reviews of the week and wish you a very happy holiday season and the best of the new year, Rose Fox.
Thank you very much, Chris. Looking forward to 2013.
Indeed. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and subscribe to our free podcast series on iTunes or at the Copyright Clearance Center website, copyright.com. Just click on Beyond the Book. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. Happy holidays to Jeremy. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.